Hello, Mike here. You may know today's guest, Ali Plum, as the cheery face of BBC Radio 1's film review shows, but in this episode, we delve deep into his journey into the business, his thoughts on having authenticity in your career, how to get the reps in to create great media, his number one piece of life advice, and of course, a few stories of interviewing movie stars like Robert Downey Jr. too. That's enough of me. Let's get going. Hello and welcome to Red Carpet Rookies. My name is Mike Battle, a film crew member turned screenwriter working in London. Each episode, I bring you life lessons and stories from the people behind your favourite movies and shows to help demystify the business for aspiring filmmakers and fans alike. Thanks for joining me. Let's get started. Today's guest earned his early entertainment industry stripes, working as a journalist for publications including Digital Spy and Empire before gaining what must be one of the world's most fun jobs as Radio 1's very own film critic, a position he has held since 2015. Since then, his career has only risen with recent projects such as hosting the red carpet of a little-known award show called the BAFTAs and BBC's new series, The Film Fan's Guide to. My guest is Ali Plum. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for that. That felt rather lovely to hear. I think I got the job in 2016, though. Or maybe I was given the job at Radio 1. They said it's yours in 2015, but I only put my boots on and started talking to Nick Grimshaw and Greg James and talking on that radio. Yeah, 2016, which is both yesterday and a million years ago because of that pandemic that still continues to be kind of a thing. But yeah, those 3 years meant for some weird movie reviewing for me. Mm. Remember 2020 when it was like, we have no new movies. How about that Tiger King? But yeah, 2016. It's been that long.
Amazing stuff. I'll have to fire LinkedIn for that one.
You do.
I ask all of my guests the same first question, and that is, what did your parents do and did it affect your career choices moving forward?
My parents did not have anything to do with the media in any fashion, and that's just how it goes, really. My dad was an accountant, is an accountant, and my mum was a nurse, is a nurse. And yeah, no connections, no through lines. I don't have an in or a buddy or a uncle or a sister's cousin's wife. I don't have any of that. So how I got the job isn't in any way nepotistic. I had an interest in movies early on for two reasons. One, my best friend, a boy at the time, called James Midgley, lived sort of up the road from me. And his dad was a sound mixer. And if you really, really, really know your onions in this world, you'll go, ah, yeah, James Midgley's dad. Yes, John Midgley. Yeah, he's a legend. He's won an Oscar. He's done some Star Wars. Wow. He did Hugo. He's worked with Scorsese. He's worked with, you name it. He's a legend in his own lunchtime. And he, as you might imagine, had a lot of movies on VHS and DVD, and I could just sit down and watch them. Mm. I remember watching Terminator 2 Judgment Day, and I couldn't have been older than 10 or 11. Just to remind you, that's a movie where someone in a dream sequence is atom bombed to bits as they hold onto a chain link fence. So, yep, learned a lot there. And the other reason why I kind of got into movies early that had nothing to do with my parents was that at my school, one of the teachers there was like a really big film buff as well. Mm. And so when you have a collection of movies that become sort of, you know, part of your life, it's just normal to be watching relative classics, and the idea of circling things in the back of the paper going, oh, well, Lawrence of Arabia is on Channel 4, BBC One, wherever it was. My mum was very good at that, but it's not a job thing. There was no like angle. Mm. And getting the gig was a sort of studied English literature at Warwick University. And then what Warwick does, or did at least, is allow for you in your second and third year, as long as you're staying within the humanities bracket that they deem acceptable, you can do different types of courses as long as you have at least two of your like units within the thing that's above the door. So if you're studying French, you need to do two French courses, modules. And then the other two can be history of art and
like America.
Like cinema, yeah. But they're not viewed as minors. I wouldn't have on my degree minor in film. But that was wonderful to have a sort of introduction to film and more whilst I was at Warwick, and I wouldn't have had the cojones to actually apply for a film course. Mm. And it was just really, it really, really, really helped me out. So yeah, I love my parents, but they didn't help me get here in that way.
Interesting. You mentioned Warwick there, and I of course wanted to ask about it. And most specifically, I wanted to hear about Raw 12:51 AM. What were your memories of student radio and what did you learn there about making good radio content media?
You have to make a lot of really bad radio content media. You need to be a terrible and inaccurate and awful self-facilitating media node. And you might tell yourself that you're fantastic and you've got loads of talent and you're full of enthusiasm and you really know your music and you really know your whatever. But in reality, I think if you're good at anything, you have to have a decent chunk of time and space and opportunity. You need to have these opportunities to be rubbish.
Mm.
And I was rubbish. I'd have this middle of the night, Tuesday night, terribly named show called Mr. Plum's Beautiful Blues, named after a Eels song.
All right.
And it was just dreadful. I remember my first day, first time I did it, I had a clicky pen and the whole thing, I was going,
oh no.
Dreadful, 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 dreadful. But you need to do it, care about it, realize it's rubbish, and then grow taste, self-awareness, and the ability to see what you've done is good and what you've done is bad. And I think the best advice I can give anybody is read, 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 watch, 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 assess, 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 and reflect, reflect, reflect. It forces you to be very neurotic and self-critical, but it is, to me, the best way of improving. You can't just fart your way through and say, yes, yes, I'm brilliant. You can't. Mm. I think you have to sort of loathe yourself a bit. And that forces you to not give up when it comes to improving or staying on top of the game or not using old turns of phrase or feeling hokey or not caring. It forces you to continue to care. And I think listeners can really tell. So I think Raw 12, 51 AM was brilliant for a number of reasons. Main one, allowed me to be rubbish ad infinitum. Also, it allowed me to be in the company of other people who similarly really cared about the media at that age. Made good friends, friends I'm still friends with today. Went to their wedding, one of their weddings the other day. And I loved it there. It was a good gang. It's like a good clubhouse. And we were at the top of the students' union.
Mm.
And again, no one was listening, but you could pretend that they were. I was head of music in my third year, unbelievably, considering I'm the movie guy now. And we hosted a show called Compact Disco.
Oy. Wow.
Oy. Which was a singles woo review show. And I loved it. I loved it. It was ridiculous and self-involved and self-indulgent. And I had a really great time.
It's an interesting thing you've picked up on there because there's a creator online called Julian Shapiro and he talks about this creativity stuff and he calls it the creativity faucet. And he's noticed that in certain top performers like Ed Sheeran and Neil Gaiman, they all talk about this exactly in the same way you did, where it's about turning on the tap, the faucet, and basically just let all this dodgy water come out. And it comes out and it comes out. And then ultimately you get the goal. John Mayer does the same thing. There's a really good video of him doing it online. So it's interesting that you've picked up on that. I wondered if, I guess you probably did the late night shift. Did you do any of that stuff at university or was that something that you probably had to do later on?
No, the late night shift is in doing a late night show.
Yeah.
They do that almost immediately. When you arrive, they just put you in the worst times, 3 o'clock on a Tuesday, 4 o'clock on a Friday, because no one's listening. So you just go ahead and do it. It was essentially a slot where, and the tech team at Raw are and were great, where it would automatically record as a digital file and then you could kind of pick it back up later. That's so good, so helpful, and allowed you to get used to faders and decks and, you know, all these buttons and knobs and just be comfortable behind a mic. It's easy to overcompensate and kind of go, wow, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. But it has to become normal for it to become normal for the listener, particularly in a podcast world where that radio vibe has kind of gone, if not entirely gone. So it's tricky. You have to maintain a different type of voice, a more pantomimey voice when you're on air, on breakfast. People are driving their kids to school, they're doing whatever, going to the shops. And you sort of have to be a bit more up there so that people can pay attention. And then conversation like this here with you today, I can be a bit more like, this is you and me at a pub. Yeah, know your own voice, get used to hating it, and then sometimes learn to love it. And I think you'll be fine, I hope.
One of the things, funnily enough, I wanted to ask you about is this podcast is about people's careers and strategies that have gone through it and things like that. It's not necessarily about asking you your most pizzazzy celebrity anecdote. And one of the things I did want to ask about was the notion of authenticity, which is something I've seen you speak about in other interviews and something I'm really interested in. Could you speak to that through your own career as well? Because you are your own, I guess, brand as Ali Plum, and that's what people are listening in for. And much like as you say, you kind of need to find that as well, don't you?
Yeah, when I first started back in 2016, I was adamant that I shouldn't really be present. I was actually unbelievably, reasonably shy. And I was panicky. And you get told, okay, X many million people are listening right now. And then you get told, do not search your name. Whatever you do, do not go on Twitter and search your name. Needless to say, you do it. You burn. You burn.
Really?
You burn. You writhe in the flames and you just think, oh, this is awful. Awful, awful, awful. The, you know, anonymity of these people getting to spit out whatever they think. But why shouldn't they? It's how they feel. And I was the new person replacing another person, and change is scary. But authenticity, there's a criticism side where I might be talking to somebody and I don't care for the movie. So say I'm talking to Robert Downey Jr. about Doolittle. The movie is not great, but I love Robert Downey Jr.
Sure.
He's a really good interview and he's a fascinating guy. So you just have to sort of pick and choose. You have to be like a good dinner party guest and go, look, I don't love this food, but I can tell you the salad's great. Am I going to nuke it? Am I going to destroy it on air? Probably not my vibe. Radio 1 isn't here to go like, that's dreadful and that's rubbish and we're just going to obliterate it. It's got to be, to my eyes, a little bit of, you might have been looking forward to this, but I'm sad to tell you it hasn't worked out. Every filmmaker, every creative enterprise is trying to do something brilliant. Now, there are outliers like Cats where you go, what were they thinking? Like, this just doesn't make any sense. And they become a sort of like, you know, punchline. But authenticity on that side of things, in terms of like impartiality, working for the BBC just changes everything and allows me to sort of say, look, here's how it is. And as long as you're not vitriolic and you're not like awful and you're not like destroying people, I think people will take criticism. You just have to find that voice and remember that other people are humans. But in terms of authenticity on air as a personality, when I got started, I wanted to fade into the background. And I think even still to this day, you'll notice the clothes I wear are very dark blue shirt, black shirt, grey shirt, a suit, but not too bright. And then kind of out of the pandemic, I went, no, I'm going to come back. And I think people are starting to press play on my interviews, even if they don't know the talent, i.e. the talent being, you know, whatever.
Amazing.
Scarlett Johansson. A little bit more. And I noticed people responding more to some of my jokes and some of my interactions more than they did, oh, that was a great question.
Mm.
What people have to remember about my stuff, if you know my stuff at all, is that I think there is, flatteringly, a lovely impression that I get 45 minutes with everyone I speak to, and then we whittle it down to 10. And that might be nice for Hot Ones or Chicken Shop Dates or other chicken-based interview shows, as well as obviously Graham Norton and the big, big, big dogs like Fallon. But, you know, I did a Harrison Ford and Phoebe Waller-Bridge interview that's just gone live today, and I got 8 minutes with him. And I was very, very grateful for those 8 minutes. That was the access. What you see on the screen is what we got.
Yeah.
And so I don't often have the time to go, right, on the fourth day of the fifth week, and you were shooting this, and then this, and then this, and then I read this here. You don't really have it. So you have to sort of walk in, be as you as you can be, give them the energy you want given back, try and show some sort of wit. You need to indicate that you've thought through your questions in a way that isn't just rote and here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. I often quote Catlin Moran, who was an inspiration for me when I was starting out and a fantastic writer, needless to say. And she said, in terms of coming up with questions and coming up with column ideas or just ideas full stop, you need to think of the fifth thought. I cannot tell you how many times I've told people about this, but it really means something to me, which is you have to look at your questions. You have to look at your plan. You have to look at your essay. You have to look at your pitch. You have to look at your everything and go, okay, right. What will the first person think straight out the gate? What will the second person think straight out the gate? What will the third person think third time around when they've thought about it four times and five times? You kind of have to go, right. Once you get to the fifth onwards, only you will have thought of those thoughts. Only you will have thought of them because it's eccentric enough or detailed enough, or there's a sort of a bit of you in there that makes you want to ask that question to Harrison Ford and no one else would. So as long as you balance your, I've got to ask these questions because they're obligation questions, with a little bit of the fifth thought, you're already doing yourself justice. And the other tip I often have about writing questions or doing interviews is write them all down on a piece of paper and then double underline and circle the questions or notes or ideas you would be upset if you didn't bring up. If you walked out the room today, and you went, oh, I really wanted to ask that. Why didn't I? Well, then make sure that doesn't happen, because if they really matter, circle them, because you will give that question more emphasis and it will feel more authentic and more real because you're like, actually, I'm really genuinely curious about this and I've got to ask you this. So that is an important part of authenticity, is sort of planning to let yourself show your enthusiasm. And I think my superpower generally is I care. If I'm interviewing somebody about Doolittle, but it's Robert Downey Jr., I care about Robert Downey Jr. and I want him to feel that. And I want the audience to feel that. So that's my authenticity. And if you find yourself not caring, stop.
Interesting. That was an amazing answer, Ali. Thank you for that.
It's very long.
It was long, but it was very good.
Thank you.
And I guess my takeaway from it as well is that the gold is often in the depth and the truth of the thing. And the truth is in that fifth thought, isn't it?
It's in the you of it. It's in the little bits you've noticed and the quirks when you are telling stories with your mates or when you were last at the pub and you had a joke. Just it's that stuff. Often people respond to a question which is ultimately, tell me a story about being on set. But you might say, tell me a story about being on set, but you go, I noticed in the blooper reel for the last film, you kept high-fiving that person. Was there a similar vibe to this one? Tell me a story of being on set.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, but you've given them a sort of cue of this is the sort of thing that I'd like you to answer with. And I've paid attention and done my research and I'm reminding you of a fun thing you did. So your brain immediately goes, dopamine, high-fiving, yeah. You know? So you just have to give people the energy you want back, whether that's in the question or in the room. And it doesn't hurt if you're a massive people pleaser who can't live their life for themselves and have to work out a sense of purpose through other people smiling and being happy and clapping. So enjoy the therapy bills, but it is part and parcel of what I do, is trying to make people like me 4 minutes at a time.
Amazing. How do you find that line between being your authentic self and asking those questions where you do have to go, wow, it's The Rock. You know, it is The Rock. It's a difficult...
I often tell people that my job is essentially improv. You will have your prepared questions. You'll have your prepared questions. They'll be on a sheet of paper. Mm. You'll have in your mind's eye how you'd like the interview to go. I'll ask this. They'll say something like that. You kind of have planned it. You have to sort of in your head also be editing. Okay, I know this footage is available for that moment. If I refer to this moment that's in the movie, but I also know that it's not available in the press pack, don't bring it up because they're not going to be able to illustrate it and it might be alienating for the audience. So you could have all these things going on in your head. But if you're feeling, oh my God, it's The Rock, let that flag fly. Like, that's fair. Don't go overboard, but like, have it out there. Like this Harrison Ford interview I just mentioned, at the very end, I was asking him, why do you think, honestly, the Indiana Jones series has been so successful? You know, I said to him, it's the humor, it's the heart, it's the action, it's kind of this perfect lightning in a bottle situation. But from your perspective, why do you think, how do you account for its success? And he was really enthusiastic and had loads of thoughts and he was very fluent and fluid, unlike me. And he just, he's very sort of short sentence kind of guy, very dry wit, not speaking very well today, very tired. And after that, I said, look, it kind of came to me. I hadn't written it down. I just said, look, this is not a question, but hearing your answer, essentially, I want to tell you how much your character and your performance means to us as the fans. We love these movies and you mean so much to us and it's been such an adventure. And if this is your final movie, thank you. It's been incredible and basically thanks. And he responded because I was being emotional to him and he was emotional back. And he got misty-eyed and I got misty-eyed and it was all a bit kind of tearful. Wow. But that's because I fully felt it and he felt it too. If you mean well, people will respond well. And if they don't, that's on them, you know?
Interesting. This all revolves around who you are, authenticity and things like that. And I guess it comes into the current world of people coming up as journalists and film critics, which is during the rise of social media.
Mm.
Your career's come up through that. You started as a writer. Now you're very prominent on social media and you've utilized it, I think, particularly well, I've noticed in my research. How has that connection with the followers sort of affected how you share your film insights? And also, do you have any advice to anyone coming up these days? Do you have to be a YouTuber to be a film critic these days?
I would say you do, yeah. And I think it's unusual for me to not have a YouTube platform in which I sit behind a camera and say, here are my thoughts on movies. It isn't output that I do. I have it on the podcast. We do spoiler specials as much as we can, and we do review roundups. I've got one planned for early next month. But I noticed, and you sort of follow the numbers, I work for a youth radio station, Radio 1, BBC Radio 1, the legendary BBC Radio.
Of course.
And ultimately, what the audience wants, we noticed, was less, here are my insightful opinions on certain upcoming movies or movies that came out relatively recently even. They wanted to see their favourite superstars doing something fun or telling us something interesting or an anecdote or a witticism or, you know, here's how the sausage gets made, an actual practical answer. That's all fine, but they wanted to see the talent. And my job has become less about being a critic and much more about being a sort of interview facilitator, a sort of energy transferer, where I give people the best side of their favorite people. You know, Brie Larson, here I am getting on with her. You're going to feel like her mate.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where my job has kind of evolved. I've gone that way. So if you are to become a critic, definitely, definitely YouTube. Letterboxd, you need to be all over it. You need to write and read and think and research and I sometimes feel a bit weird calling myself a critic because it isn't a core part of what I do professionally. It's what's on my business card, figuratively. And that's more or less it these days. I've got tons of opinions and I say them as much as I can, but it isn't the prime objective of what I do. So yeah, I have thoughts, but yes, you do need YouTube and you need to really, really work hard because opinions are now free. And if you're going to be the person who's selling free opinions, they better be really good. You better really work hard to differentiate yourself from all the others who are doing something very similar. And it can't just be a pink hat.
No dark blue shirts.
No dark blue shirts there. No way. No beardy monotone men. That is booked up.
Now, to wrap up on every episode, I do a quick little questionnaire, which is my own ode to In the Actor's Studio, with my own questions. So if you could think of the first things that pop into your head, Ali, if that's okay. The first question is, what is one of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
Well, I mentioned that one from Catlin Moran, which is very good, the fifth thought. So I'll immediately mention that again. But ultimately, I said it before, read, 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 listen, 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 consume, 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 assess, assess, assess. Know that it is your passion. If you're going to work in the movies or TV or gaming world, you have to really, really care and just do it. Do it and listen and make it part of your day. Try to watch a movie a day or every 2 days or whatever. Just make it part of your routine because it's an easy habit to fall out of. You need to really, really put the work in. And people, if you're putting yourself in a position where you want to be thought of as an expert or a passionate person about a topic, do your homework. Do it. So yeah, that would be my advice. Also, just like I mentioned earlier, be careful, but remember to assess yourself and work out what's good and what's not. Keep social media at an arm's length if you can, mute what you can. But also, if a note does come through the internet that you're a bit like this and you're a bit like that, it's going to make you go, ah, screw them, that's awful, how could you, that's so bad. But then there might be actually something good in there. It might be delivered with barbs and spikes and it might hurt, but maybe that might actually help you. Give yourself a moment and go, okay, I can remember that. There's probably something there. Unless it's like fully bonkers, there might be something to it. And I've picked up a few notes like that.
They say that in screenwriting, the note isn't the note. It just shows that there's something there and then you have to work it out.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Number two, do you have a favourite film?
I do have a favourite film. It's The Big Lebowski. And I often try to work out what the favourite film, you know, what does that mean? And to me, it could be interpreted as, oh, I've watched it the most times.
Sure.
But then if you do it that way, that's The Muppets Christmas Carol, because I've watched it every single year for the past like 15 years. So does that count? Probably not. So what is the movie that I would like to put on in any given mood? Probably Singing in the Rain. I'm never not in the mood. Nice. Pop that on. You're having a good time. But The Big Lebowski has the quotes, the tone, the actors, the performances, the depth, the eccentricity, the Coeniness, the Jeff Bridgesiness. I just grew up with it with my brother, and I've got all sorts of merch. I've got like a bowling ball shaped DVD case. I've got artwork on my wall. I've got a DVD that comes in a steelbook that has its own miniature cardigan. I've got the works. I love The Big Lebowski, and if they'd allowed me, I'd have had it as my movie mastermind, or rather celebrity mastermind topic. But the argument was that if it's about a movie, then sort of cheating.
Yeah, playing your own game. Yet you still won.
Yeah, I still won. Because read, read, read. Assess, assess, assess. Worry, worry, worry. Stress, stress, stress.
Number three is, what gives you a reason to get out of bed every day for a day of film reviewing?
Caffeine. The fact that my job is the best in the world and I'm very, very lucky. And the idea that I could say anything else as an answer to that is ridiculous. It's absurd what I do. And I'm so grateful to any and all gods that have allowed this to happen, and to my bosses and to the listeners and to the viewers and to anyone who's ever said anything nice in a comment or on Twitter or on Instagram or whatever. It means so much to me. And I want everyone to know, if they'll ever let me tell them, that I don't take this for granted and I am having the time of my life, and I'm hoping that my joy and happiness in doing what I do is something you can take a hold of and enjoy as well.
Love that gratitude. Beautiful. And number four, which job in the industry would you do if you weren't doing yours?
Well, then you can answer that by going, well, the upgrade of mine. So if someone said, okay, Graham Norton's put his hat on the stand and he's off, obviously I'd love to do that. I think James Corden left. Maybe they need another white Brit man to come over and take that job. No, they don't. But Yeah, I suppose that's the easy answer. Sort of what I do, but sort of supersized. Because I think I do, I think I'm good at it now. I think I've done it enough. And I think I'm good at it. So yeah, those would be my answers. But otherwise, you know, it would be nice to be working in the props department of a Bond movie. That was always a daydream of mine. And when I was a kid, absurdly, I really wanted to be a continuity announcer.
Wow, that's specific.
Because I remember asking my mum, I went, who's this person doing, that was the news at 10 and now it's whatever. And my mum said, oh, they're called continuity announcers. I was like, that's their job. And in my head, I went, so you watch telly all day and then in between the episodes of the fun things, you go, yeah, that was Robot Wars. And
cheers.
Yeah, here's
here you go.
Cash in the Attic. I don't know. And I thought, that's brilliant. And my parents, you know, bless them, were very keen on my brother and I sounding as English as possible because they immigrated from South Africa. And they really, 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 and Zimbabwe. And they really wanted us, to be blunt, to sound as from nowhere as possible. And I went, well, I sound like I'm as English as I possibly could.
Yeah.
I'll be like a Radio 4 bod. I don't know. That I've always, if you could give me a present, it would be, I'm a Radio 4 or Channel 4 or whatever, going, that was that and this is this and coming up next.
Continuity, man. Got it.
Yeah. Don't think you were expecting that answer.
I was not. I've not had that one before. If you could interview one person, living or dead, who would it be?
I want to give you a living answer because I get asked this a lot and I increasingly want it to happen, but I'd love to do a Movies That Made Me with Meryl Streep.
Okay.
And I'd like to do another one with Steven Spielberg. I've already done one, but it was about his sci-fi films. And I'd love to do another one, but with his everything else, which is an enormous one. And Desert Island Discs is one of the best things on the planet. Interview program, it's just second to none and is jewel in the BBC's crown. It's outrageous. But his Desert Island Discs was very good. And I think Laurent Verne's outstanding. And I'd love to spend more time with him. But living or dead, I don't know. Kubrick? I mean, sit down and talk to Hitchcock, I mean. That would be incredible.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd particularly pick up what I'm putting down in terms of, you know, this YouTube, TikTok-friendly shtick. But I'd have a ton of questions. I'd have a ton of questions. So yeah, let's go for Hitchcock for awesome. Dead and Streep for a living.
Lovely. Penultimate question. What is a book, ideally career-focused, but it really doesn't have to be, that everyone should read?
Which Lie Did I Tell by William Goldman? Is a classic. I'm sure you've talked about it many times. And the other one would be Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which is another sort of a decade in the life of cinema. So there's a two sort of like, oh, you want to get into sort of film, eh?
Mm.
Here's some very readable, very interesting stuff. Also, my friend Phil Desemlian, or rather his brother Nick Desemlian, sorry guys, has written a book about 90s and 80s action heroes called Last Action Hero.
Nice.
Was it Last Action Heroes? Anyway, and that's a fascinating read. And he did another one about the 80s comedy SNL wave called Wild and Crazy Guys. So I'd recommend those two because they're fascinating, informative, and funny.
Amazing. And the final question, if you won an Oscar, who would you thank?
I thank everybody. I thank my parents and I thank my bosses, particularly a man called Joe Harland, who works here at Radio 1 and has been a real supportive presence and has backed me time and again, particularly as I veered into the Viz side of things and did a lot on iPlayer. Increasingly, as I said earlier, more and more visual stuff. And he has been such a defender of what I do. And I owe him so much. But also my big boss here, Alid, a guy called Ben Cooper, who first hired me, and partners and friends who've supported me along the way because, you know, I was one of 12 people, I'm sure, that got very, very close to getting this job in 2016, and they happened to pick me. And by the grace of God, go I. Like, that's just like it. That's not the phrase, but it was just a random bit of kismet. I happened to get picked. It worked out. You know, I got on very well with Nick Grimshaw in the chemistry test, and it worked out. So I'd like to thank a lot, and I'd like to thank my friends and family, and I'd like to thank you, the audience.
Your Twitter fans.
I'd just like to thank.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time today and your honesty and some really quite profound career advice in there, Ali. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Red Carpet Rookies. To help us grow and be able to interview more amazing film and TV professionals, please do subscribe and drop us a rating on the Apple Podcast Store on your iPhone or online if you're an Android user. If you're interested in regular updates, the best thing you can do is to join our mailing list at redcarpetrookies.com or alternatively, find us on Instagram at redcarpetrookies or Twitter at rcrookiespod. I also tweet regularly about my own learnings in the business at Mike F. Battle on Twitter, so please do come and say hi. Thank you again for listening. We'll see you next time.